Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
The late, great David Cornwell was first a British spy, then the internationally acclaimed author John le Carré, and at the end of his life, an Irishman. His son has now reintroduced his father's legendary spy master, George Smiley, in the brand new novel Carla's Choice, to the delight and excitement of all the le Carré fans out there. Nick Harkaway, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Where is the greater risk or the greatest amount of pressure for you? Is it taking on the iconic Smiley in the new novel or stepping away from your own acclaimed writing for a moment at least?
Oh, good question. It feels as if there might be a risk wherever I go. I think it has to be the first one, that this incredible canvas of 20th century writing that sort of defined the Cold War. And I have the sheer hubris to say, oh yeah, I can do that.
What exactly is George Smiley's legacy to the world? It's a big question.
But it is a big question.
He's such a figure.
What I would like to think it is the idea of compassion, even in the kind of in the grey zone between two kind of enormous clashing ideologies. You still have to do ultimately the right thing if you can, you know, which is kind of, you know, Smiley tries to do the right thing, not just in this book, but elsewhere, even when maybe he shouldn't, you know, and when he crosses that line, he's very conscious of it and he's very unhappy with it. And I think, you know, as we look around the world, we could probably use a bit of that.
Yeah, I think your father really, he was kind of inspired by, in a negative way, the James Bond version of espionage. And he wanted this kind of sophisticated, closer to reality version. And out of that comes the unlikely figure of George Smiley. Is that fair to say?
I think that's probably fair-ish, yes. I mean, there was that very James Bond sort of version, and then there was sort of Bulldog Drummond stories, very kind of muscular and militarised. And he wanted to tell a story about people, you know, who are flawed and who experience these kind of impossible dilemmas, and, you know, and tell espionage stories from that place.
So you and your family, you decided we'll bring George Smiley back. And rather helpfully, your father has left plenty of gaps in the George Smiley canon, huge gaps, as it turns out, timeline-wise, for
yes.
which you to kind of mine all of these extra stories.
Gaps and wiggle room, because the dates shift a little bit, because he wasn't writing franchise, he was writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there's a 9-year gap in the storyline between The Spy Came From the Cold, the definitive kind of Cold War noir story, and Tinker Tailor, you know, which was sort of much more Byzantine and ornamented and so on, into which I can fit this story and have it belong to itself. You know, it obviously can reference those two, but it has space to be its own thing, which is, you know, I think terribly important, because you don't just want to be doing infill, you want to do something that has its own merit.
And into this, the spy, it's really directly after The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, essentially, isn't it? But George Smiley is still, he's still in grief for what
yes.
he did there, just as the
yes.
Cold War had begun. Well, the Cold War was underway, but the Berlin Wall had gone up.
Exactly so, yes. And it's interesting, when my father wrote Legacy of Spies in 2017, or came out in 2017, he was suddenly struck by Smiley's involvement in what happens in The Spy Who Came From the Cold, which I won't spoil. But I found it, he found it incomprehensible. And I actually think, in the context of the Cold War, where it felt like this kind of looming darkness, you know, I think actually everything that happens is understandable, even if it's not right, you know. But so I wanted Smiley in grief. And of course, there's a kind of mirror there for me as well, because, you know, this is my dad's world, and he died in 2020. And here I am kind of, you know, stepping in.
Very soon, because, well, you've effectively already stepped in, because the last time I spoke to you was about 3 years ago with Silverview.
Yes, yes.
Which was, it was that a complete novel? Did you have to finish it off? I can't quite remember.
No, it was absolutely complete. Well, for that, we had the manuscript or the typescript, but
yeah.
we didn't, you know, but you can't just print the typescript. You have to go through the edit process to make it kind of, you know, tidied up. And so I sat in the chair for that one. But I don't think there's more than three lines of that I wrote. And those are obviously kind of linking passages to just make edits make sense.
Mm. I presume you've read the New York Times. They've been looking back at Silverview, haven't they? Assuming these are some of the things in Silverview that your dad couldn't say while he was alive, and that you've now carried on through Carla's Choice.
Yes, that's right. Well, I don't know about couldn't say. He remained, in a funny way, very loyal to his old service. He kept all their secrets. So, people always kind of assume that at some point he would have sat me down and told me, you know, this is what I really did in the Cold War. But he never did. So anything that I know about him is also in the public domain. I have no secrets in that regard. But so he kept their secrets, and they knew that. A lot of, you know, people, old intelligence officers used to sort of sidle up to him in the street and say, terribly nice to see you, and I'm always very admiring, and so on. It was, and they'd sort of pop out from round corners in bookshops. It was actually kind of Peter Sellers-like.
And this is your life, because you remember as a child your father reading out these passages of his latest novel.
Yes. Yeah, always. Every morning he'd get up very, very early and he'd work and he'd have coffee and come to the breakfast table and he'd read to my mum across the table the new pages. And then, you know, she'd type them and he'd read them again and so on. And there was an interplay between them. And so he was writing the Smiley novels in the 70s, and I was born in 72. So actually, while I was acquiring language and learning to speak English, an hour and a half of my day at least was Smiley. So when I came to write this book, he was just waiting for me.
George Smiley taught you how to speak, essentially, some of the language. Well, there's no better mark for your credentials on writing it than that, if you didn't already have them. Smiley, his motivations we know, and they constantly are being ploughed through in the story, but his operations are, in your father's book, always sort of, he's at a distance, isn't he? He's like a passive character in many ways, where you make him both passive and active in this story.
Yes, I mean, he's definitely pulls the strings in Tinker Tailor rather than kind of doing the difficult stuff himself. But, you know, but we also know retrospectively that he did something quite daring in the Second World War. We don't know what it was, but he was frightened. He was in Germany and so on. And so that's sort of canonically known. So we know he was a field agent. So I thought we'll give him a little bit of that, because here we are. It's the early 60s. You know, he hasn't quite just decided to sit behind a desk yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, but at the same time, again, very much not James Bond. You know, when it gets dangerous in the field, Smiley's not happy about it. Doesn't enjoy that at all. There's no kind of ha-ha, now I shall do this. It's very much, oh no.
I love him trying to remember his field training for a car chase.
Yes.
Drive very fast and don't hit things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and that's, you know, I have this conviction also that one of the reasons that we love Smiley is the sense that although he's a sort of Sherlock Holmesy genius, we also feel that he's kind of us.
Yes.
You know, he's ordinary, but with skills we might acquire. And so the notion that he, you know, if that was me, I would 100% be going, oh, I can't remember. Hang on, what am I supposed to do at the corners? You know, do I slow down or do I speed up and hope?
Always middle-aged as well, isn't he? Does he grow old?
I will thank you to call him in his prime. He's the same age as me.
Okay, very good. Our prime.
Our prime. But he remains, for the most part, he remains a kind of undifferentiated 50-something. Mm. But then he gets a little bit older when he retires in Smiley's People. But his age is a little bit all over the map.
Just an amazing, brilliant character, and you must be pleased, because doing something like this so high profile was going to attract the attention of the exalted publications of the world. I presume you've been reading the reviews, because they've been so good.
I have a cast iron rule that I don't read them, but my wife reads them. I get the highlights, but then I'm also shielded from anything that will upset me. Which I have to say there hasn't really been.
Well, Telegraph asks, is this new Le Carré even better than the master himself?
As you will perhaps be unsurprised to hear, I feel a bit ambivalent about that one. On the one hand, I'm delighted. On the other hand, I feel a little bit kind of disloyal even hearing it.
Mick Herron, who of course people will know from who wrote The Slow Horses, a note perfect tribute, fits seamlessly into the world of Smiley's circus. I mean, there's quite a lot of Smiley in his world, isn't there?
Yeah, and he came and he gave the memorial lecture for my dad down in West Penwith in Cornwall. We had the first lecture a little while ago, and he was brilliant, and he was wonderful about my dad, and you know how much he admired him, and so on. And also, I mean, I don't know if you must have had Mick on the show, but he's one of the nicest men in the world,
really?
You know. So that's also just a great kind of, you know, it's a lovely thing to have Mick kind of saying that.
I wonder, are some of the reviews in saying maybe it could be better because of the times we're in? The reviews are mentioning that your female characters are more rounded than previous Le Carré novels, which I think even your dad touched on himself, didn't he?
He did. Well, and it's, you know, it's one of those things, without wishing to get armchair psychiatry about it or psychology about it. He, you know, his mother left when he was five for good and sufficient reason, by the way. You can't blame her because his dad was a monster, you know. But that relationship was never repaired. You know, he found her and he had a, you know, they knew each other and he looked after her when she was old. But you know, it was never made good. Mm-hmm. And so to some extent, in the earlier part of his life, you know, what women did was disappear on you. You know, that was his emotional bedrock understanding. That changed as he got older, until in some of the post-Cold War novels, actually, you know, as it gets on, the female characters are very strong, and he was working very hard towards that. And I have a particular fondness for a couple of them because they have hints of my wife in there. But in some ways, the book is obviously a little bit anachronistic in terms of his style or whatever. Because I'm pushing the things that he wanted to be achieving later, maybe a little bit into the Smiley corpus. But I feel it blends. You don't really, you know, if you're a reviewer, you might notice. But in 2024, if you're just a reader, you go, yeah, no, of course.
Just talking about Ronnie's, who you're talking about, which is your dad's father.
Yes.
And he's the inspiration in A Perfect Spy, isn't he? It's incredible.
Yes, very much
incredible,
so.
A novel. So Le Carré put his dad in the stories. Is your dad in yours now?
I think he is, in the sense that I think I poured bits of him into Smiley. And I mean, to some extent, he's already Smiley. He has to be, because you know, you create a character like that. But you know, there's always this conversation about whether Gwilym is my dad and Smiley is the sort of father figure he made up and so on. So for me, I put my dad into Smiley.
Okay. What did you put in specifically?
I put in, well, with the relationship between George and Anne, I wanted that to make sense in a new way. I wanted people to see it and want it to work and see why it didn't.
Right.
And with my parents, it's the opposite. Their relationship was sort of non-conventional in a way, but it worked brilliantly. And so it's the inversion of that. But there's, you know, their interplay in some ways is similar. But and my dad's kind of sense of, as I say, compassion and slightly kind of horror at how the world works is in Smiley.
I mean, Smiley's, he's very happy, certainly at the start of this story.
In this, yes, exactly. Well, because obviously when you're a novelist, if you want something to be awful, you show it wonderful first and then you take it away.
It's almost difficult to talk about Carla's choice in many ways, because as in the Le Carré novel, and this is where you're being praised quite a lot, it starts out with a plot that untangles beyond where it starts out, essentially.
Yeah, it always somehow begins with something trivial. And again, I think that's very Sherlock Holmesy. You know, it's a sort of, it starts as an interesting problem. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it turns out to be the critical thing. Writing it was a very kind of nervous dance between the raindrops in terms of not revealing things that shouldn't be revealed and so on.
Well, also the fact that it's so different from what you have been writing. Genre melding novels, dystopian, futuristic thrillers, a bit of spying here and there, but sort of dreamlike qualities to them, isn't it fair to say?
Yes.
Was your dad a fan of your own writing?
We always had these very interestingly fraught conversations where it was never clear to me how much of my books he read. He was always, you know, he always sort of announced that he dipped into it, quote unquote, and you know, it was very good and so on. But I never
dipped in.
He didn't read a lot of fiction generally. And I said this to my brother the other day, and he said, "Well, you know, he used to claim that he was dipping in, but whenever I talked to him at any length, he seemed remarkably well informed about the twists and turns of your plots." So Simon's conviction is very much that he read them all. And he was very supportive and kind.
When did you start reading his novels?
I'm not even conscious of when I started, because they were, you know, like I say, they were ambient.
Childhood.
They were I started listening to the Michael Jason audio recordings very, very early, as part of my kind of going to sleep if nobody could read to me, if they were busy or whatever. And then later, you know, I came to the books, but I couldn't put a date on it. It was just always there.
Are you a huge fan? Did you read absolutely everything? Did you have to reread to go back here?
I absolutely did reread, yeah. And I built a little kind of speculative timeline, because the dates are always a bit contingent one on another and so on. So I've got a notional timeline of Smiley's Circus and so on. And yes, I am a fan. But also, you know, I mean, you talked about kind of the difference between what I normally write and this. And the thing is that when I came to it, I think because of that thing about sort of Smiley being my kind of learning to speak companion, I didn't have to turn the dial very far to find a voice which is absolutely mine, but which people read as being his.
Extraordinary. It was sorry. I'm again sorry to see or sorry to read that you lost both of your parents really quickly after each other. Your dad went first. He was 89, almost 90.
He was almost 90, yeah.
At the end of 2020. And he died an Irishman.
He did, yes. That was a really big thing for him. He went and made a visit, and the archivist sort of threw wide her arms and said, "Welcome home." And he was so moved. I think for most of his life, really, without knowing it, he was looking for a place that would take him in without condition, you know. And here it was, and it was just, and you know, she was prepared to say welcome home just on the strength of, you know, who he was without asking. And that meant something to him on a fundamental level.
I want to play it here. It was in October 2019 and he was being interviewed by Marion Finucane, who's a huge deal in Ireland. She was a huge Le Carré fan, always wanted to interview him, and she managed to do so just a few months before she died herself. And it is about this coming home for him. He was furious about Brexit and he really wanted that Harbin's passport. Let's have a listen.
"I was completely enchanted by my journey to Ireland, where I visited my grandmother's birthplace in Inchinatin, near Ross Carberry in County Cork. And that was where she grew up, and that was where, at the age of 16, from there, she went to England as a lady's maid. I went to Skibbereen, where there is a heritage centre, and a wonderful lady called Margaret Murphy, an archivist, first of all, rather sternly, looked at her computer for a long while. And then she turned up to me and with a beautiful smile and said, 'Welcome home.'"
And there it is.
And there it is. And it was very, very shortly before he died, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I have to say, the wonderful thing is, by the time I heard that story, she had a kind of leather-bound book rather than a computer. It got better in the telling.
Yes, he was a good storyteller.
He was
in
a good storyteller.
As well, yeah.
I love it. So there we go. Now I'm educated. But yeah, no, and I tell you, listening to his voice is extraordinary, because that's his voice in late age. And then as you go back, you hear the sort of the deeper, slightly less crackly version of that. But there's a transition moment where when he was in the 70s, particularly in the 60s and 70s, when he was first famous, he had a very fake High Etonian voice, which he used for interviews. Yes, it sounded sort of, yes, when you write a novel, people ask you the question, did you make this up, or were you? And it was nonsense. It never belonged to him. And he actually says in the Pigeon Tunnel, the interview for the documentary film that they made, he says, "I adopted the class and voice, the manners and voice of a class that was not my own." And I hadn't really heard it because I was too young.
Yeah.
And then I was listening to that on one of the kind of clips. I was like, good Lord, what was this? And if you can get hold of it, the audiobook that he read of The Spy Came from the Cold in 1981, he starts out with the American-handed Limas, another cup of coffee, and then he goes into the American voice, and he can't do the crazy British voice, and he goes into his own for a couple of lines. And I was listening to that, I was like, that we should make a show just about that, because this kind of adopted voice giving way to the real one, because it's who he really was.
I mean, the lovely story for us is that this once MI6 spy finishes off as an Irishman.
I cannot tell you how much it meant to him. When he died, I'd actually started, and I'm not even going to try, I'd started learning Irish, we were going to learn it together.
Oh, really?
We wanted to do a journey together into Irish and Ireland. Mm-hmm. I got cracking on it. And then, you know, obviously when he died, I got a little bit, it fell away for me rather, because it was a bit painful because we never quite started off. I can't emphasize enough how much it meant to him.
You became fluent in Smiley instead.
I became fluent. Thank you very much. I'm going to use that. Yes, exactly. I did.
Do you? Would you qualify for an Irish passport yourself?
I wouldn't. I'd have to come. And I do. I think about it quite a lot, actually. I haven't sort of stepped in that direction yet. But it's always actually, and my nephew is getting married in Ireland to an Irish lady. So.
Oh, great! The connection.
The connection is yes. We're all kind of
you've a great
we're all
grandmother.
Aware.
Yeah, so you would actually need the circus and perhaps even control to get involved to
yes,
secure.
Yes, exactly. No, we'd, yeah, but for him. it was a really real, tangible thing. And it was something. There's a silly picture. I gave him an Irish flag on his birthday because he just got the notification through that he'd been registered, and we were all a bit plastered inevitably. So there's a photograph, and it's of course upside down.
But the Ivory Coast.
I think he then put it on his chair in his workroom upside down too. So we've got this kind of glorious but terribly embarrassing picture. But I don't know whether it makes it better or worse that he was maybe a little bit the worse for booze.
I've seen that photograph. It's a joyous one.
It almost makes sense
that it's upside down. There's an SOS message.
Yeah. Well, and I said it to someone the other day, a friend of mine from Ireland, who said, you know, well, frankly, you want to see how many times that gets done by people who should know better. So
I hope you still have the flag.
Oh, I do, except that I've actually lent it to the Bodleian because there's an exhibition of his archive. And I made them promise that they would get it the right way round.
Yes, OK. Because I would say it is a brilliant artifact, so it's even better that it's on display.
It is a brilliant artifact, although obviously it's a slightly embarrassing kind of not very well-made one that I bought from a certain online retailer in a hurry.
Yeah, I think it's lovely that your whole family are involved now in the whole Carré legacy, and between the films, the documentary film was there. Will there be more now from you or others in terms of George Smiley? Are you going to go back to your own work? What happens next?
So first of all, when I said I would do this, we kind of made a very light touch agreement that I would be allowed to do my own stuff as well. If I was going to have the opportunity to do more of these, I would alternate or something. So I will do more of the things that I would normally be doing. And in fact, I've got Sleeper Beach, the second Cal Sounder novel, coming out next year. Whether I do another George Smiley novel is sort of slightly contingent on how this one goes. And after this weekend, it's looking rather likely because it's, you know, the reception has been so extraordinary.
It's going to be a clamour.
So I have some notes towards the next one, but we haven't sort of put that in stone.
There will be a clamour for film versions as well. And because because you're doing this, there's obviously that the shades of a row about Gary Oldman, isn't there? His agent claiming that you blocked him.
It's actually his manager who said that. Yes, but because I'm not really involved. I couldn't answer that. And of course, because they had pictures of me from previous stuff, they put me front and centre of that story. And I was sitting there going, hang on, there's three sons and two of them are film producers. One of them's a novelist. Who are you going to ask about this? But I don't know what's going on there. But I tell you what I do know is that the other thing that's been said recently is, why hasn't Gary Oldman got a knighthood? And I think that's a great question. I think we should all call the palace. Honestly, I think that's a good one.
Well, you won't be a true Irishman if you're calling for people to be knighted, for goodness sake. We frown on that sort of thing.
That's true. Well, you know, but I mean, a little bit of fancy dress never did anyone any harm.
Okay, look, that's an answer that that Ronnie would be proud of. Never mind Smiley or anybody in there. Nick Harkaway, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much. Carla's Choice is absolutely magnificent and a worthy successor or involvement in the whole Smiley universe. So enjoy to everyone, all the fans out there who are going to get their hands on it. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. Online car insurance that's driven to save you time and money.